Can you attach a part amount? A garnish order may either attach the entire balance standing to the credit of the customer, or it may be issued even for a specified amount sufficient to satisfy the judgment debts and cost. The complaint amount is what that matters, not the total quantum of amount. If only a specified amount is attached, the customer can obviously use the remaining amount, because the remaining amount is not disputed. Only the specified amount needs to be transferred to the court for delivery to the judgment creditor. What happens to the money deposited before the garnishee order is issued? Money deposited before the garnishee order is always a debt due. The order will attach such money also. We have a famous case in case of Jones and Company versus the Coventry, where in a garnishee order can have no prospective operation. What does that mean? If the money is not in the bank at the time of order is served, it cannot be attached. So garnishee order is issued on an amount which is there in the account at the time of its issue. What do you mean by a garnishee order and right of set off? We'll see more on the rights of the banker in our next chapter. Let's see what relationship a garnishee order has with a right of set off. A garnishee order entitles the bank to set off credit balances of the customer against any of his actual indebtedness to the bank. Before paying the balance into the court or to the judgment creditor, the bank can exercise its right of set off and deduct from the balance any debt due from the customer which existed at the time of order. So even if it's a court order, the banker has full right to set off any of its previous debt. Only then it can remit the balance as per the court instructions. For this purpose, he can combine all the accounts of the customer which he could previously have set off without notice to the customer. This is the banker's right. You don't have to take any confirmation from the customer, especially in such cases of set offs. The banker cannot retain the balance or any part to meet a contingent liability. Contingent liability simply means a liability happening in the future or happening on certain eventuality. So the banker cannot retain the balance to meet such contingent liabilities. With regard to term loans, the banker may not be able to exercise his right of set off for installments falling due at future dates. How can you set off installments that are going to come into picture in future dates? Such future dates set offs are not allowed. Nevertheless, the banker should inform the court of its lien on the amount attached and the balance in the loan account so that the court will consider that a loss is not suffered by the bank because of such remittance to the judgment creditor. Now we come to a very important topic of attachment orders issued by the income tax authorities. Section 226 subclause 3 empowers the income tax authorities to attach the credit balances held in the bank accounts of an SSE in case of defaults in payment of tax dues. The income tax authorities have full right under the Income Tax Act to have attachments on the credit balances in the bank accounts if the customer defaults in making his income tax payments. If an attachment order is issued, the bank is bound to comply with the order and pay the amounts to the income tax authorities as demanded. Here you don't require any consent of the customer. Banker's prime obligation is to comply with the regulatory authorities. The order covers all accounts, which includes your saving account, current account, as well as your term deposits. However, with regard to the term deposits or the time deposits, the order should be complied with only after the deposit has matured and not before maturity. What are the attachable debts? The debt should be due or accruing, and the amount from the bank becomes due when the demand is raised. The transaction is completed before the service of order. Cleared balance is only attached by the order. Under a garnishee order, only monies which belong to the customer in his own account can be attached. This particular slide is giving you all a list of all the attachable debts. To go further, if the account is a joint account with either or both to sign, the court cannot attach the account in a joint name if the order so furnished is in a single person's name. So we see that the debt should be due or accruing, and the amount from the bank becomes due when the demand is made. This is the prime requirement of an attachable debt. The transaction is completed before the service of the order. There should be some debt due to the judgment creditor before the service of the order. How can you appropriate an order for some future debts? Cleared balance only can be attached, not unclear balances. And two more exceptions in this: under a garnishee order, only monies which belong to the court customer in his own account can be attached and not in joint accounts. In case of joint account with either or both to sign, the court cannot attach the account in a joint name if the order so furnished is in single person's name only. We have some more in the attachable debts list. If the customer has validly assigned to the third party the amount of the balance or any part thereof, and the banker has received a notice of the assignment and the assignment is made is genuine, the garnishee order will not apply up to the amount assigned has ceased to be the property of the customer. Suppose this is some valid payment. Such valid payments are made to some income tax authority, to some insurance companies. The check is already issued. How can you stop? The banker would also be entitled to set off a debt due to itself at the time of order nisi against the balance attached, provided the conditions in which a right to set off can be exercised. Obligation for wrongful dishonor of checks. Whenever such instances happen, a banker has to make a decision as to honor a check or not. It may seek explanations from the court and decide what the fate of such honoring of checks, rather than to fall into some trouble. If a banker, without justification, dishonors his customer's check, he will be held liable to compensate the customer for injury to his credit, because the banker's prime obligation is to honor checks. Only under certain exceptions, that is regulatory authorities issuing such stopping of checks or immediate remittances of the balance, then only the banker has a right to dishonor. But if there is no such provision, no such existence of such regulatory order, and in spite of that a banker dishonors the check, then it has to compensate the customer for such negligence. The amount of compensation recoverable by the drawer of a check from a banker in case of wrongful dishonor is not limited to the actual pecuniary loss sustained by reason of such dishonor. The customer is entitled to claim substantial damages, which means over and above the pecuniary damages, pecuniary losses, the customer can claim substantial damages even if he has sustained no actual pecuniary loss. Such damages may be on causes of mental torture and other hurt caused to him because of such transaction. The court will be in a position to decide what would be the quantum of such compensation, provided he can show that his credit has suffered to that extent by the dishonor of check. So the court will take a cognizance of the status of the customer, the hurt caused to him because of some such dishonor of check, the effect on the goodwill, on the image of the customer because of such dishonor of the check, and based on all these factors, the court will decide on the quantum of compensation. Once again, in a famous case of Canara Bank versus IV Raj Gopal, the court observed that mere expression of regret is not the answer. In such cases where the bank is at fault, the amount of damages is not based on the amount of the check dishonored. Please note, is not based on the amount of check dishonored, but on how the customer's reputation and creditworthiness has been affected. So here again the court places prominence to the customer's reputation and the creditworthiness of the customer. Here the amount may be very small, but there may be a serious impact on the customer's reputation and creditworthiness, which has to be adequately compensated. Remedy for a check wrongfully dishonored lies in a special authority, and this special authority is a civil court. In Shakuntala Devi versus Punjab National Bank, the bank was liable for all the authorized acts of employees who are empowered to deal with third parties. Here the employees come secondary, the bank comes primary. So the bank was held liable for all the authorized acts of the employees who are empowered to deal with the third parties. Similarly, if a post-dated check is honored, we have seen in our previous slides, you cannot honor a post-dated check. Is honored by the banker before the date of the check, and thus the balance in the customer's account is reduced, the banker would be liable for wrongful dishonor of the check subsequently presented for payments. The liability of a bank for a wrongful dishonor of a check is towards the drawer and not towards the payee. The payee cannot claim damages. The account holder or the drawer can take the banker to the task and ask him questions and compensation for such wrongful dishonor. The payee may take the issue separately with the drawer, but the payee cannot directly claim compensation from the drawer's bank. Obligation to return the dishonored check to the customer. When the check of a customer sent for collection is dishonored by the drawee bank, it is a duty of the bank to return the check to the customer, based on which the customer can take up the issue on those persons who have given him the check for a consideration or for whatever purpose, or to intimate the customer regarding the dishonor if the check has been misplaced. So the first obligation comes in returning the dishonored check to the customer, and if at all the check is lost in transit or for some by some other reasons, it has to intimate about the loss as well as the dishonor of the check, otherwise the banker would be held liable. The banks are obliged to act in accordance with the customer's instructions. The banker is bound to act according to the directions given by the customer. In the absence of directions, he should not act according to the usage in the locality and the applicable to the matter in hand. The banker is also expected to use reasonable skill and diligence in his work, otherwise he will be liable for damages. This entire slide puts certain obligations on the part of the banker. The first point says the banker is bound to act according to the directions given by the customer. It cannot act on its own. It requires certain instructions from the customer to act on behalf of the customer. The second part is, in the absence of directions, he should act according to the usage in the locality and the applicable to the matter in hand. Like we have the famous Clayton's rule, first in, first out. If there are no directions given by the customer, the banker, by way of usage of this Clayton's rule, can apply the first in, first out, the first debit against the first credit. The banker is also expected to use reasonable skill and diligence in his work. He cannot say, I could not, I tried my best. Sorry, you have to use a reasonable skill and diligence in his work, otherwise he will be held liable for damages. Even though different persons have different skills, but an average skill set, a reasonable skill set is expected from a banker because he is handling a very important portfolio, and hence he has to use reasonable skills and have diligence in his work, otherwise he would be held liable. And this throws out very important obligations on the part of banker. Liability of the bank for embezzlement committed by the employees. We have seen in the previous slide also, certain wrong things created by the employees as a part of their banking business. A banker is primarily liable. He is obliged to make good the loss. In case of embezzlement committed by the employee, the bank is liable if a fraud is committed by an employee in the course of his employment, not otherwise. If there is no connection with the banking business, how can the bank be held liable? But if it is connected with the banking business, then definitely the bank is liable if a fraud is committed by an employee in the course of the employment. In case of State Bank versus Shama Devi, the Supreme Court had held that the employer is liable for fraud perpetrated by an employee in the course of employer's business, irrespective of whether it was done for the benefit of employer or not. Benefit of employer has nothing to do with compensation for fraud committed by an employee. The moment a fraud is made, the bank is responsible, and this has been decided by the Apex Court, which is the Supreme Court of India. In Bank of Bihar versus Mahabir Lal and others, the Supreme Court has held that the manager intended to make the employee the bank's agent. Therefore, the bank as a master was liable because the principal cannot say that any act of his agent he is not liable. A principal is always liable for his agent, hence a bank as a master will always be liable for any act committed by its employee during the banking business. United Bank of India Limited versus Mohammad Shahmud Suddin and others. It was held that all the customers has to prove to make the bank liable is to prove that the agent was working within the scope of his authority. So once it is established, whatever the fraud or embezzlement or the misappropriation is done by the employee within the scope of his authority, that is working as an employee of the bank, once that is established, the bank would be held liable. It is not necessary to prove that the act was for the benefit of the master or not. Hence, it becomes very essential on the part of the bank to educate its staff about consequences of such acts. It not only damages the reputation of the bank staff, but it damages the reputation and goodwill of the entire bank. The secretary, Nanguneri Peace Memorial Cooperative Urban Bank Limited versus Alamelu Amal. The secretary of the bank issued forged fixed deposit receipt to a customer. The rules of the organization did not empower or permit a secretary to issue the fixed deposit receipts as he had acted beyond his authority or in the course of employment. The Madras High Court held that bank was not liable. Why did the court decide the bank was not liable? Let's see this. The secretary of the bank had issued forged fixed deposit receipt to a customer. Okay. The rules of the organization did not empower or permit the secretary to issue fixed deposit receipts. So there was no authority vested on the secretary to issue the fixed deposit receipts. As he had acted beyond the authority or in the course of the employment, like it's a simple case of the security person which stands at the entrance of the bank door, issues some forged fixed deposit receipts and collects money, will the bank be held liable? So this is a particular case wherein the Madras High Court has held that a bank was not liable as no such authority was vested on the employee during the course of banking business. The supposition that strangers are entitled to assume all things connected in the transactions and pertaining to the bank's internal management has been properly done has no application to fraud. The bank becomes primary liable whenever a fraud or forged instrument such as a forgery made instruments are paid as such instruments by default are null and void. Any act done by unauthorized officials, whereas any act done on forged instruments are having different interpretations, which has to be carefully noted. The bank is obliged to provide services to its customers. In addition to giving all other commitments towards the account, a banker is also obliged to provide services other than related to the account to its customers. Bank must provide services to the customers irrespective of whether the customer is a debtor or a creditor. There you cannot have discriminations. If the customer owes a large sum of money to the bank and has failed to repay it, the bank is at liberty to initiate a suit or other appropriate proceedings against the customer for recovery of its alleged dues. So nobody can stop the banker from recovering the damages through proper legal routes. However, he shall provide, that is, the bank shall provide its services to the customer so as to enable him to carry on his normal day-to-day business transaction. Filing a suit using alternative recovery methodologies is different, but that does not stop or should not stop the bank from providing its services to its customers to enable him to carry on his normal day-to-day business transactions. Secrecy of customer's account, topmost obligation on the part of banker. The banker must not disclose the condition of his customer's account except on reasonable and proper occasions, and the obligation to observe secrecy does not end even with closing of customer's account. So not only during the tenure of the account with the bank, but even after closure of the account, the bank has no business to dilute the security or divert information of the closed account to any other entity. Such disclosures can be made only under special exceptions, such as when demanded by the regulatory authorities, such as court, income tax authorities, etc. Disclosure is justified in certain cases wherein answering questions by a proposed guarantor or under compulsion of law. A guarantor has the right to ask about to whom he is going to become a surety, what type of account he is maintaining, otherwise he would be held liable. Compulsions of law, court order, income tax authorities, police authorities, compulsion of law, disclosure is justified with the express or implied consent of the customer. Sometimes the customer may wish, either expressly or impliedly, to disclose information for his specific purposes. Where the customer has given his banker as a reference, the banker will be fully justified in answering all the trade references invited by the customer. By order of the court, this also comes under your compulsion of law, under a public duty to disclose, as in case of danger of treason to the state. This comes specifically in cases of your money laundering activities, your financing of terrorism activities, wherein it's prime duty or prime obligation of the banker to report such suspicious transactions, to report such money laundering transactions to the Financial Intelligence Unit India, FIU IND, which is based in Delhi, or to some appropriate authorities as provided under the law. Some more cases of justified disclosures: when the protection of the banker's own interest legally requires, the banker is justified in disclosing the state of his account, as in an action against the customer for money due. When a bank calls upon a guarantor for payment, giving the amount of indebtedness of his customer for which the guarantor is liable, the disclosure is justified. So both ways, when the guarantor requests as well as when the banker wants to invoke the guarantee, wants to bring to the notice of the guarantor, that time such disclosure is possible. What do you mean by when the protection of the banker's own interest legally require? The banker is justified in the state of his account as in an action against the customer for money due. So whenever the bank wants to seek action against the customer for money due, during these periods, the disclosure may happen to courts, to some tribunals, for the benefit of recovery or protecting the interests of the bank. Provisions under various statutes which empower the officers to require a banker to furnish information regarding the client's account. Here we say this as the compulsions under law. The first one, to be more specific, section 131 of Indian Income Tax Act, section 37 of the Wealth Tax Act 1957, section 36 of again Wealth Tax Act 1958, Section 94 of Criminal Procedure Code, and provisions of the Customs Act. But each of these regulatory acts has a special way of making request, and such disclosure has to come in a proper manner so that the purpose is served and such information is not going into the wrong hands. In addition to whatever we discussed in the previous slide, you have some more disclosures. Bankers Book Evidence Act 1891 permits certified copies of entries to be produced in the legal proceedings. A banker need not carry its ledger or its computer to the court, whereas the recent provisions also enables the banker to have its certified electronic copies to produce as an evidence to the court of law. The Reserve Bank of India Act 1934 empowers the Reserve Bank to collect credit information from the banking companies. The Banking Regulation Act 1949 requires every banking company to submit return on unclaimed deposits accounts every year. So this also becomes a disclosure, but these disclosures are permitted under this regulatory norms. Section 11 of Foreign Exchange Management Act empowers the Reserve Bank of India to call for any information from an authorized dealer, more specifically on foreign exchange transactions. Section 235 and 237 of the Companies Act 1956 empowers the central government to appoint inspectors to investigate the affairs of the company. Here again, you have to produce all the documents or the books of accounts that are maintained by the company for inspection and investigation. If a public sector undertaking seeks information about an employee's bank account, the bank is bound to give it, because a public sector bank can demand such information for various purposes, to protect its own interest or to protect the interest of the society. We have a very good case in the form of Cuttabowman Transport Corporation Limited versus State Bank of Travancore. The court held that a refusal to share information by the bank is not justified, as the bank has a higher duty to safeguard larger public interests. Here the safeguarding of larger public interest is very important while taking such decisions than the interest that of the private duty to protect customer secrecy. So the bank has to make wise decisions, make a decision at the senior level whenever it takes a decision to refuse to share information from some authorized entities. Common courtesy. Bankers will, as a common courtesy, give another bank information. Sharing of information between the bankers is a practice by usage for protecting the interests of the bankers as well as the customers. Information given in response to such inquiries should not be shared, but it should be given confidentially and is worded with scrupulous care so as to disclose no more than the general position of the customer. You cannot dig into each and every detail and disclose. Such disclosure may be only in the form of general disclosure. Such cases are permissible. This is because there is an implied consent of the customer derived from evidence of a well-known practice amongst the bankers and the circumstances giving rise to the inquiry. And this is very important. Bankers, as a common courtesy, give another banker's information of a customer, but in a very general position, not in a specific position. When a bank gives information about this or his customer's account, he must adhere to the facts as disclosed by the account and not give his own colors added to the customer's account. Such information should be given only to the fellow banker or to a person authorized by the customer to receive such information in confidence and without prejudice. It should not be detrimental to the interest of the customer. It should be based on the facts, and it should be given for a specific person, either on customer's behalf or on a requisition made by a fellow banker. The information should be as far as possible very general to avoid any liability as to any claim for defamation or a fraudulent misrepresentation made by the customer on a later date. The banker may make himself liable to the party to whom the information is given to compensate him for the loss which the latter may suffer on account of having relied on such information, provided it can be proved that the banker gave information knowing it to be false or without having justifiable reason to believe it to be true. A very important slide which says that the banker may make himself liable to the party to whom the information is given to compensate him for the loss which the latter may suffer on account of having relied on such information, provided it can be proved that the banker gave information knowing it to be false. So it becomes very important for the banker to ensure that whatever information he is sharing is on the basis of facts and not on his own presumptions and assumptions, or without having justified reason to believe it to be true. So friends, that is very important as far as the banker obligation is concerned. It should be noted that if a banker is to give information about a client's account, he should ensure that he adheres to the facts as discussed in the account and not his own presumptions. He must not convey anything heard as a rumor, again that boils down to the basic facts only. So if you have to conclude banking or bankers' obligations, we can say the banks has traditionally shown immense concern for the customers. With more and more regulations being introduced, banks are forced to make more care of the customers and implement secure solution without compromising on speed and accuracy while providing products and services. Banks are more conscious of customers' needs and are continuously aspiring to add value to the customer by offering excellent customer service through a wide range of products without any defects in products, efficiency or services. And that ends our chapter with specific focus on banking obligations. Bankers do have their own rights, but it is very important that when they are improving day by day, when they are getting latest technology on hand, they should see that they are more careful and not negligent while providing various products and services to the customer, and has to follow all the terms and conditions entered into different capacities with their customers. Thank you.